ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. For nearly 40 years, the show has been asking the best writers, thinkers, and provocateurs big questions about our changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
But as institutions collapse, narcissists thrive.
And people were willing to take risks.
4 brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, Hilary Harper here from Radio National's new weekly show, History Showcase. Today I've jumped into the Good Ship Rewind to introduce a 3-part series from our friends at Radio New Zealand. William Ray, host of RNZ's Black Sheep podcast, brings us the story of what's been described as the worst war crime ever committed by Australian and New Zealand soldiers, the Surafend Massacre of December 1918. Here's William with episode 1 of Anzac Massacre.
Kia ora, ko William Ray aho, no mai ngā hibi pāngo. Hi there, I'm William Ray. Welcome to Black Sheep. Monday, the 16th of December, 1918. We're in southern Palestine, near the city of Rishon LeZion. Today, this city's part of the modern state of Israel, just south of Tel Aviv, near Ben-Gurion Airport. But in December 1918, Rishon was crammed with soldiers, including several thousand war-weary men from the Anzac Mounted Division. The First World War had ended just a few weeks earlier. The troops are celebrating Christmas in a few days' time and then looking forward to finally sailing home. But they aren't relaxing today. There's tension in the air. The division's standing at attention on the parade ground, formed up in a hollow square with a space in the middle. Their commander, British General Sir Edmund Allenby, gallops up on his black charger. He rides to the centre of the square and raises his voice so all the troops could hear him.
There was a time when I was proud of you men of the Anzac Mounted Division. I am proud of you no longer. Today, I think you are nothing but a lot of cowards and murderers.
What happened next is disputed. Some say Allenby's words were received in silence. Others say there was a muttering and murmuring among the troops. One soldier said it sounded like millions of hives of angry bees. And some say that after hearing those words from General Allenby, the Anzacs started to count. Here's how one anonymous former New Zealand trooper described it.
There was a slow swelling murmur from the troops, and then the count began. 1, 2, 3. General Chaytor sensed the feeling of the men and told Allenby he would soon be unable to hold his troops. Without answering Chaytor's salute, Allenby wheeled his horse and galloped off to the strain of 8, 9, 10, out! We Anzacs are not men to be sat on.
Whether or not General Allenby really did ride off in fear as he was counted out by the Anzacs, this story's emblematic of the fury some of those troops felt about his comments, calling them cowards and murderers. It's a far cry from what you'd expect from a commander who'd led troops through 3 years of a campaign which one historian's called one of the greatest of 20th century warfare. In the months and years that followed, General Allenby did soften his tone somewhat. He praised the Anzacs for their service. But he never forgave or forgot what some of those troops did just after the war ended. A cold-blooded massacre at a place known as Surafend.
You know, for a sergeant to be killed like that, you know, and everyone was a bit head up with that sort of thing.
That's right. And yeah.
They do things you wouldn't do normally in this.
No.
But they did. They went in there. Yeah.
This is a recording of Edward O'Brien, an Australian veteran of the Anzac Mounted Division. He was being interviewed by an oral historian in 1988 when, for some reason, he started talking about Surafend.
A New Zealand sergeant was killed, a Bedouin, and apparently there were some others there, and they turned on him, they killed him.
Did they?
A New Zealand sergeant.
It's a bit hard to follow Edward here. He was a very old man when this was being recorded, and I don't know if the recording gear was state-of-the-art even in the 80s. But his interviewer knew the story he was talking about. It goes like this. At midnight on December 9th, 1918, a New Zealand soldier, Leslie Lowry, was shot and killed while chasing an unidentified thief out of his tent. By the time other troops arrived, the killer was gone. But a trail of footprints allegedly led to a nearby village, Surafend.
So they got their heads together and everything like that in New Zealand and the Australians, they went out to this village and they went through it with the bayonet.
Did they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In case you didn't catch that, Edward O'Brien said they went through it with the bayonet.
The Australians, the New Zealanders, and the Scots go into that village. They kill every able-bodied male. They burn the village and then they go to a nearby Bedouin camp and do something pretty similar.
Murder, assault, arson, looting. Under British military law, which the Anzacs were still subject to, some of those attracted the death penalty.
It's the calculating nature of the killings at Surafend that really chill you. I think without any doubt at all, by far the worst war crime committed by New Zealand military personnel.
Usually on Black Sheep, we tell the stories of individual people. And I'd like to be able to tell you that there was one particular person or group who carried out the killings at Surafend. Then we could go back and say, you know, oh yes, Sergeant Smith grew up reading sensationalist newspaper reports about the Māori in Sudan and became Islamophobic because of that, and his diary entries show he was a really great mate with Trooper Lowry and was devastated by his death, and so on and so on. But we can't say that. Because we don't know who did it. Or even exactly what they did.
The thing that really surprises me more than anything is how they kept it so quiet. It never got out. Ever.
This is Terry Kinlock. He's a military historian and author of a number of books, including Devils on Horses, a history of the New Zealand Mounted Rifles Brigade, which was part of the Anzac Mounted Division. The subject of the Mounted Division first piqued Terry's interest when he was serving in the New Zealand Defence Force. These days, being a mounted rifle in the army means being mounted on some kind of military vehicle. But back in the First World War, being in the mounted rifle still meant being mounted on a horse. You didn't charge into battle like a knight on horseback, instead you fought on foot. But you used horses to move rapidly from position to position, outflanking your enemy and getting away quickly if you needed to. As Terry Kinlock said, during the First World War, Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles was one of several New Zealand and Australian mounted regiments which were part of the Anzac Mounted Division. and it was men from that division which carried out the massacre at Surafend. To start, let's fast forward quickly through the first 2 years of the war. In June 1914, an Archduke gets assassinated, armies mobilise and smash into each other in Europe, and then they get bogged down in trench warfare. New Zealand and Australia join the war alongside Britain, and in April 1915, the Anzacs are sent to Gallipoli to fight the Ottoman Empire. The Gallipoli campaign, as any school kid can tell you, is a disaster. In 8 months, more than 10,000 Australians and New Zealanders are killed, and many more wounded. In January 1916, the Anzacs abandon Gallipoli and retreat to Egypt to recover.
Our infantry are built up to a complete infantry division. They're sent to the Western Front, finally. The mounted troops, the New Zealand Mounted Rifles and the Australian Light Horse, stayed in Egypt because there was no work for horsemen in the Western Front. It's just trench warfare. But somebody had to protect the canal against the Turks, who were not very far away.
The canal Terry Kinloch mentioned is the Suez Canal. And just like today, the Suez was an absolutely critical shipping route.
Troops from New Zealand, Australia, India, food from those same places, all went through the Suez Canal. So that had to be kept open. We were left there, that's what the mounted thought. They'd been left there while the infantry went off to fight the real war. They were left to languish in Egypt.
But they didn't languish for long. The Ottoman Empire knew that losing the Suez Canal would be a disaster for the British. All through 1915, while the Anzacs were fighting in Gallipoli, the Ottomans had raided British positions, disrupting or blocking supply lines. So, in January of 1916, the Mounted Rifles rode out to confront the Turks. First in small raids and reconnaissance missions, then in force. The two-year campaign which followed was completely unlike what you typically imagine for combat in the First World War.
Western Front trench warfare, very immobile, just two opposing lines of trenches, 400 kilometres long, machine guns, heavy artillery, barbed wire, poison gas, all of that. And then completely differently to that in the Middle East, because it's effectively desert, lots of open terrain, practically no poison gas used, barbed wire very rare, very little artillery, relatively easy for mobile troops to move. That's completely different.
As a result of all this, the casualties for the Anzacs in the Sinai were far lower than on the Western Front or at Gallipoli. But fighting in the desert came with its own unique horrors.
Very hot, very little water, spiders, snakes, scorpions, tarantulas, malaria, all sorts of parasites and things from the drinking water. Food was dreadful, there's nowhere to go on leave. If you're on the Western Front and you got some leave, you go to the UK and spend your leave in London. If you got leave in the Middle East, you went to Cairo if you're lucky, usually not even that.
I think the thing that struck me most about the campaign in the Sinai was the threat from enemy aircraft. Riding through the desert, there was just nowhere to hide from enemy fighters.
Unless you stood still. If you stood stock still, when there was a German aircraft overhead, which there were, even if there was a regiment of you with horses, if you stood stock still, they often wouldn't see you. If they saw you, they would drop bombs on you. And that killed a lot of horses, actually. A lot of our horses were killed by German bombs from aircraft.
But, on the whole, the Allied forces, not just the New Zealanders and Australians, they do really well in this campaign.
Yeah,
Just steadily pushing the Turks back.
Yeah. It's one of the great successes of 20th century warfare. And it was just a coincidence of all those things. Mobile troops, horses and camels that they could use to cover very large distances very quickly. A relatively weak enemy. The Turks weren't particularly strong and they weren't particularly aggressive.
But the Anzacs and the Turks weren't alone in the desert. The Sinai was, and still is, home to a people known as the Bedouin. In accounts from Anzac soldiers, the words Arab and Bedouin are often used interchangeably, but the distinction is that while all Bedouin are Arabs, not all Arabs are Bedouin. The word Bedouin basically translates as desert dweller. They're a nomadic people who've survived for thousands of years herding animals through the deserts of North Africa and the Middle East.
Because there's so little to eat, they can't stay in one place. You know, they just basically go from water source to water source, and there might be some date palms. When that was consumed, and they'd move, and they just wandered. To them, the war, I mean, it wasn't their war. They've been there for thousands of years before anyone else turned up, and all of a sudden this industrial warfare arrives right on top of them. It's completely foreign to them.
During the Sinai campaign, the Anzacs were told that any Bedouin they came across in the desert were probably allied with the Turks, seeing as both were overwhelmingly Muslim. And many Bedouin did join the Turkish side. The Ottoman Sultan, Mehmed V, had declared a jihad against the Allies, essentially demanding all Muslims join the Ottoman side of the conflict.
Some Bedouin decide to ally themselves with the Turks. Some decide to ally themselves with the Allies. Some decide just to have nothing to do with it and just hope that it goes away. And those Bedouin who allied themselves with the Turks, that's the start of what eventually became the Surafend incident.
The thing is, it wasn't always easy for the Anzacs to tell which Bedouin tribes were hostile, especially as tribes shifted allegiance as the war went on.
British policy in the Sinai was to intern any Bedouin that they caught. So they assumed that any Bedouin in the desert was working for the enemy, so they captured them and put them in prisoner of war cages for the duration of the war.
And is the main concern there just spying?
Yeah.
Spying was the main concern, but not the only one. Here's how New Zealand veteran Ted Andrews put it in his 1962 book, Kiwi Trooper.
The troops had suffered casualties throughout the Sinai and Palestine campaigns by treachery of the Arabs, who were seldom, if ever, punished. All stores had to be guarded against looting, sentries were murdered, and the dead at Rafa were dug up and stripped of their clothes.
We'll be getting more into those claims, which of them are true, and how they relate to what eventually happened at Surafend in our next episode. For now, just know that resentment is there, bubbling away beneath the surface. Throughout 1916, the Anzacs fought their way across the Sinai Desert in a spectacularly successful campaign. They were riding through the night to outflank enemy defences, carrying out commando raids to sabotage rail tracks, scouting, spotting for artillery. It's genuinely a really impressive story, and you can read all about it in Terry's book. But as the Anzacs pushed towards Palestine, resistance strengthened.
One of the major cities of the Ottoman Empire was Jerusalem. They were really reluctant to give up Jerusalem without a fight. And also, there was a railway running from Turkey all the way down into what is now Saudi Arabia. It's called the Hejaz Railway. And that was a major supply line for Turkish forces all the way down that part of the desert. So there's Jerusalem and there's the Hejaz Railway. That are probably the two most important things the Turks had to protect.
As the Turks committed more troops, the Middle East campaign turned into a grinding conflict.
If anything, the Palestine part of the campaign was closer to Western Front, certainly than the Sinai was. Because the forces were bigger, they started to get German artillery, started to come in, and all those sorts of things started to happen.
But as 1917 drew to a close, the Anzacs and other Allied forces continued to push forward. On the 7th of November, they captured Gaza. On the 8th of December, they took Jerusalem.
I guess it probably varied soldier to soldier, but to what degree were people conscious of fighting in the Holy Land, and that was that important to them or not particularly?
You'll see the odd reference to someone who, you know, there was one of the regimental commanders when he got to the border between Sinai and Palestine, got off his horse and knelt down and gave thanks for having the privilege of riding into the Holy Land. It's a bit of that, not a lot.
And they didn't seem to have any particular animosity towards Muslims.
No. Some of them had come through the Gallipoli campaign, and there's a well-known sympathy between Anzacs and Turks when they were fighting on Gallipoli. There was no sense of hatred, you know, from the Anzacs towards the Turks or vice versa. There was like a shared experience. And those mounted riflemen that after Gallipoli continued to fight into the Middle East kept that. So there was much more of a sympathetic attitude between the Anzacs and the Turks than there was between the Anzacs and the Bedouin.
Maybe the most extraordinary example of this difference in attitude towards Turks and Arabs came right at the end of the war. It happened in late September 1918, near a place called Ziza Station, 25 kilometres south of Amman, the modern capital of Jordan.
Remember I mentioned that there was the Hejaz Railway. There was a large Turkish force way down the bottom of that railway. And as the war turned against the Ottomans, that force had to move itself out of danger back up into Palestine, where the rest of the Ottoman army was. The only way they could do that was on the Hejaz Railway.
The Turkish army was retreating on foot along the railway because the trains and rail infrastructure had been destroyed by Arabic forces who'd made an alliance with the British. If you know about T.E. Lawrence, the famous Lawrence of Arabia, this is probably a familiar story.
There was a force of Arabs involved in that campaign called the Hejaz Arabs. They were Bedouin, but they would consider themselves a cut above, you know, the Bedouins in Sinai and Palestine. And they were close on the heels of the Turks, who were withdrawing up the line of the railway. And every chance they could get to cut off a few Turks and kill them, they did. It was brutal. So there's several thousand Turks retreating up the line of the railway with thousands of Hejaz Arabs sniping around the flanks, riding in on their camels to capture a few and to, you know, drag them off and kill them.
The Anzac Mounted Division was camped north of this retreating Turkish army near Amman when they got news of what was happening.
And they send down some riders to talk to the Turks to say, surrender. You know what's going to happen to you if you don't. These Arabs will kill all of you.
The Turkish commander agrees to surrender, but on one condition.
He won't surrender unless the Anzacs come in and join the defence against the Hejaz Arabs, because they think that if they surrender without the protection of the Anzacs, they'll be killed. The Ottoman Empire had occupied, you know, huge swaths of the Middle East for hundreds of years, and they weren't, you know, benign occupiers. They were brutal overlords of the Arabs, and that had been going on for hundreds of years. And all of a sudden, there's an opportunity for the Arabs to get back on top.
Next, the Anzacs meet with the leaders of the Hejaz Arabs, who demand that either the Anzacs join their attack on the Turks or disarm them and hand them over. The Anzacs refuse. Instead, they turn their horses back towards the Turkish camp.
The Anzacs, Australians and New Zealanders ride down, meet up with this Turkish force, and then go into the defensive line with them.
As night falls, skirmishes break out along the line. The Anzacs pick up their weapons to defend the Turks.
And they're fighting off the Hejaz Arabs, who are our allies. They're allies.
Are they actually shooting at the at the Hejaz Arabs?
Yeah.
They are?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a really bizarre thing. And again, it's this sympathetic attitude between the Anzacs and the Turks that comes from Gallipoli, opposed to, you know, as far as the Anzacs are concerned, the Hejaz Arabs are probably no better than Bedouin.
The ranking Anzac officer, Lieutenant Colonel Donald Cameron, said the Turkish officers he met appeared utterly defeated, even though they outnumbered the forces attacking them.
The Turkish army was terrified of the Bedouin. Several instances occurred during the day of Bedouin capturing odd Turks.
Lieutenant Colonel Cameron's troops clearly felt sorry for the Turks. Here's a quote from Sergeant Darcy Longy of Queen Alexandra's regiment.
Like hordes of vultures, the Arabs and Bedouins were out in force preying upon the Turks, out for murder and loot. We had always respected the Turk for his courage, endurance, and fair observation of the rules of war. But as for these desert pariahs, our so-called allies, we had nothing but blazing hatred.
Eventually, the Hejaz Arabs rode off in disgust. The Anzacs disarmed the Turks and marched them back to camp. When they arrived, some were so desperate for water that they burned themselves trying to drink from the boiler of a steam engine. This skirmish at Ziza Station was among the last battles the Anzac Mounted Division fought in the First World War. On the 30th of October 1918, the Ottoman Empire signed an armistice. Germany would sign its own peace deal 2 weeks later, on November 11th. The war was over. But for some of the division, that blazing hatred Sergeant Darcy Longy described was still smouldering. And on the night of December 10th, with the murder of Leslie Lowry, it would flare up to engulf the village of Surafend.
The response of the men is to get command to go to the village, to cordon around it and ask for the killer to be surrendered.
The Anzacs take all the women and children out of the village, and then they go into the village and they beat at least 40 Arab males to death.
Massacre always strikes me as rather an indiscriminate thing. The killings at Sarafim were quite deliberate. I just would think it more of a mass murder.
In the next episode, we'll look at those killings at Surafend, and also the questions which still linger. Who was responsible? Why did they do it? And why was nobody ever punished? Thanks for listening, and special thanks to my guests in this series, Terry Kinlock, Paul Daly, and John Crawford. Black Sheep is written and presented by me, William Ray. Our sound engineers are William Saunders and Mark Chesterman. Our production coordinator is Brianna Juritich, and the executive producer is Tim Watkin. And you can always see or read more about this story on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/blacksheep. Mā te wā.
Join host William Ray next time here on Rewind for episode 2 of Anzac Massacre, about the shocking events in the Bedouin village of Surafend in December 1918. I'm Hilary Harper, and you can join me for more deep diving into the past on History Showcase every Monday afternoon at 2 p.m. on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.